Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the London Review Bookshop. It's really fantastic to see such a packed house. It's not working. Can you turn? It's fine. The speakers are pointing backwards. Well, we're delighted to welcome here tonight Francis King, with Martin Goodman talking to him. It feels a little like an anniversary, this, because it's on the occasion of the release of Francis King's 50th book, which is... set in the year that... or around the time that his first book was published, 60 years ago. It's been a fantastic career. Alan Massey wrote of him in The Spectator that he writes a fiction of... I've written it. Detailed observation and sympathetic imagination. And I think that's as true now as it always has been. Professor Martin Goodman of the Philip Larkin Center for Poetry and Creative Writing in Hull is here to interview him. Without further ado, I will hand you over. Welcome, Francis King.
Thank you, Laura. Hello, everybody. Yes, we're sharing the events from Hull. This is our first event that we're calling Larkin About, the Philip Larkin Centre, touching different places around the country. And we're absolutely delighted to have this opportunity to meet with Francis and to celebrate Francis. Also, I'd like to thank English Pen, who did a lot to notify people and turn this into a pen celebration, because Francis, of course, had a remarkable life. His first book was published 64 years ago, which makes 50 books seem a little bit slack. But in that time, of course, he's also dedicated an enormous amount of time to the benefit of all writers, as the president of English Pen, but also the president of International Pen. And he's also, obviously, worked full-time for the British Council in many areas around the globe. So it's a very active life, celebrating sort of English culture and truly adding to it with some of the sort of the finest novels going. And he's also, I think, in this new novel called Snap, come up with probably the timeliest title of the decade. I'm pleased to see you're full. I've just heard that some people are actually wanting to come, but they're snowed in Shropshire. And the book, we're going to be sort of featuring the book quite sort of largely in the conversation. But for those of you who haven't read it, which it's only just sort of just come out, it must be most of you, we won't give the game away, we won't give the story away, but we'll find out hopefully some of the those writing tricks and some of that sort of genius of Francis that's been applied to this book. And in the opening page of this book, Francis, you speak about the war. About the winter. It just seemed to go on and on and on forever. This was the winter of 1947. No, and this book is set in Oxford, in post-war Oxford. And it's the meeting of this group of sort of English people based around the university and several German prisoners of war.
That's right.
And this page says that the winter goes on and on and on, somewhat like the war did. And so this equation of the war and of winter. Often we think about war causing divisions. War is about divisions. But somehow I think your novel talks about how everybody is healing those divisions, but also how war was something that was actually shared by both Germany and Britain. They all experience war, just as they're all countries in the northern climes and experiencing winter. And so winter brings people together in this novel in quite a real way. I wonder if you could just say something about your sense of this sort of English and German divide and the use of winter in your book as well.
Well, one of the things that impressed me immediately after the war was the British were really feeling two things. And one was genuinely a compassion for the Germans, and certainly many English people in Oxford went out of their way to do what they could for the prisoners of war. And at the same time, a quite virulent wish to get their own back. So there was a conflict of emotion. I tried to bring this out in the, I mean, the girl in my book. I don't want to portray too much about the book, but the heroine of the book, she's divided at first. I mean, at first she thinks, well, these are just people I see in buses being driven out to their work, and she doesn't want to have anything more to do with them. I mean, she's not so inhuman that she would like to kick them or beat them up or anything, but she just feels she doesn't want to have anything to do with these people. For her, they're outcasts. And then she slowly realizes that these are human beings, in most cases, totally lacking in any responsibility for the terrible things that went on. They were merely bullied by the state and went on with it, just as many soldiers in Iraq or wherever you like to think do things they shouldn't do, simply because they're obeying their superiors. So that is really was the major theme of the book, was this division of feeling and how slowly this girl falls in love with a prisoner of war and all the difficulties that occur. And the coldness represents partly this frozen relationship, but at the same time, as Martin rightly says, in a curious way it brings them together, because it's an external suffering imposed by nature, and people also trying to help each other. It really was a far worse cold snap than the one that we're having. People probably, a few of you may have been children then and will remember, but fuel was extremely scarce, food was rationed. But the curious thing is that I think at that period, in 1947, it may have been a result of all the hardships of the war, but people were far more buoyant and tougher about the whole situation. And the other day, I was traveling in a bus to Oxford, and we had to do a great detour because of the weather. And there was an old woman sitting next to me, and she asked me, we got into conversation. And I said, I had this novel coming out. And she was a resident in Oxford, and she'd been a child in Oxford at the time. And she said, oh, wasn't it fun? We were skating on the river. I mean, she regards it as a time of enjoyment. And I try to bring that out as well.
You're a true professional trying to sell your book to somebody on a bus.
Well, she raised it.
And for me, you actually evoke Oxford in many real ways. And there's one part that I'd actually like you to read to settle people into some sense of the flavor of the book.
Yes.
When we're entering the fairground, it's near the end of the book. But it isn't giving games away, like I say, and it's a nice, neat story in itself. So, Francis, if you'd be happy to read us.
Yes, certainly. Here we are. They pushed their way through a mass of laughing, sweating people in their best weekend clothes and emerged onto an open space surrounded by sideshows. While a small boy was noisily vomiting into the grass, his mother stood unconcerned beside him, his half-finished ice cream cone held in her hand. From the nearby swings, there came the piercing screams of girls clutching at their billowing skirts. An old drunk in a cloth cap with an almost bridgeless nose lurched against Thomas and then demanded, who do you think you're shoving? Fucking kraut, he muttered as he staggered off. A few drops of rain fell out of the clear sky. It was unusually hot and humid for March. Christine found herself taking a perverse, self-taunting pleasure in the ugliness of the scene. She had always loved fairs with their din, their milling crowds, and their smells of cheap scent, sweat, and frying food. But now the garishness and crudity filled her with arrogant distaste. Perched on some railings, a boy with an acne-scarred face let out a piercing whistle as she passed him, hands pulling at the corners of his mouth so that he looked like a malevolent gargoyle. Her contempt and loathing intensified. Mind out, Fritz. Two workmen in overalls thrust their way past, hefting a roundabout horse between them. One of them looked down at Christine's legs and shouted at Thomas, "You're in luck today, aren't you?" A few more drops of rain spattered down out of the clear sky. The amplifier of the giant Ferris wheel at the centre of the fair was blaring out, "I want to be happy." A baby in an apparently unattended pram began to wail. No one paid any attention to it. "Let's go," Thomas said in a low, miserable voice. "Why do we stay here?" At that moment, a group of youths overtook them. One of them elbowed Thomas, and another put a hand on his shoulders and pushed him aside. Then another turned, and with an attempt at playfulness, flipped off his cap. Wearily, lips compressed, Thomas picked up the cap and dusted it off on his sleeve. His mouth sagged like a child's on the verge of tears. "Fuck you," he muttered. He clutched Christine's arm. "Why do we not leave?" "No, it's all rather fun. Enjoy yourself, let yourself go." She was now hating the whole scene even more than ever. But she felt a desire not merely to hurt and humiliate him, but by descending deeper and deeper into the revulsion and horror with which the crowds now filled her, to batter her sensibilities until she lost all feeling. She found herself obsessively searching out more and more sordid details of the scene. Even the condoms abandoned by couples, many of them no doubt prisoners and their girlfriends, who had used the area as their place of assignation before the arrival of the fair, compelled her fastidious, fascinated gaze. "Let's go on the wheel." He stared at her, bewildered and stricken. "But it's so noisy and maybe dangerous." "Dangerous? Don't be silly. They have all sorts of safety regulations. Come on." Reluctantly, he trailed after her, to wait in a jostling crowd for the wheel to descend and halt for its next load. Not far ahead of them, a large woman in a man's black overcoat turned to survey the queue and then began to cackle with laughter, her mouth so wide open that Christine could see her uvula wriggling up and down like a baby's finger. Thomas turned away, imagining that her boisterous mirth was directed at him and Christine, rather than at some of her friends immediately behind them. At last their turn came, and they squeezed themselves into a tiny, swaying gondola. They were so tightly packed that Thomas had to slip an arm round Christine's waist. The two youths in the gondola ahead were attempting to spit down onto the ancient, elongated greyhound, asleep below the wheel on a bed of straw. From time to time, the dog grunted, looked up at the ascending wheel, and scratched an ear. Yet again, the amplifier began to blare out, "I want to be happy." The gondola creaked, jerked forward, jerked backwards, and then juddered off. A strand of Christine's hair blew across Thomas's mouth. Impatiently, he brushed it away, even though in the past he had always taken so much pleasure in stroking it or kissing it. As he rose higher, his arm tightened round her waist. Far away, they could now glimpse the winding river, the squat station, the soaring towers of Christchurch and All Souls, and the entrance to the camp. Immediately below, the crowds milled, shouted, laughed, sweated, embraced, won and lost money, sucked their ice creams, smoked their cigarettes. But she wouldn't look below. However briefly, they had escaped from all that, as onto a mountain peak. "Oh, Thomas, I love you, how much I love you." She had forgotten that during their argument earlier, she had called him Doubting Thomas. She felt towards him none of the previous exasperation and despair, only tenderness. She rested her head on his chest, feeling the pressure of his collarbone through his rough battle-dress tunic. suddenly the gondola jolted and tipped, first forward and then more violently back, while the music briefly became a discordantly amplified screech before grating into silence. Almost at the summit of their ascent, they were now motionless, dangling over a void. One of the two boys ahead let out an anguished wail. The amplifier began to crackle. Then, over the crackling, a North Country accent voice boomed. "Nothing to worry about, ladies and gents. We'll have this fixed in a moment now. Just keep calm, ladies and gents, and enjoy the view. That's the way, just keep calm." All the couples in their gondolas remained eerily still and silent. Slumped, many of them with their arms round each other. They might have been dummies. Christine stared down at the moon faces staring up. Strangely, she felt no fear. Then she looked at Thomas. Their gazes interlocked for a second until he turned his head aside and downwards. His eyes were now fixed on the faces below. His own face, clammy and white, lips drawn back in an extraordinary rictus, expressed only terror. She grasped his hand and squeezed it tighter and tighter. "It's all right, perfectly all right. They'll have it mended any moment now. Don't worry." Again the North Country voice reverberated over the crackling static. "Be patient, ladies and gentlemen. No problem, no problem at all. You'll soon be travelling down." "Look at Tom Tower," Christine pointed. "Doesn't it look wonderful in the setting sun? What a view." She was not merely trying to distract him from his panic. The beauty of it all genuinely overwhelmed her. She wriggled in the narrow seat in an attempt to look behind her. As the gondola shuddered at her sudden movement, his hand shot out to clutch the strut beside him. "And one can see all the camp. I never realized how huge it is. Look." But he did not look. His eyes were squeezed shut. When he opened his eyes, he asked in the voice of a fretful, frightened child, "Why are we not moving?" "We will, soon." Minutes passed, and gradually she sensed the panic ebbing from him. His body, previously so taut against hers, began to relax. His face was no longer ashen and glistening. "Okay, ladies and gents, that seems to be fixed. Hold on tight now." Thomas let out a small groan as the gondola shuddered, swayed from side to side, and began to jerk upwards as though with tremendous effort. He again gripped Christine's hand. At last it reached the summit, and then slowly and smoothly began its descent. He gave a delighted laugh. "Everything is all right. It always was, silly."
Very well read, Francis, but thanks. Listening to that again, I just, as a sort of a teacher of creative writing, there's just so many things that you could actually encourage people towards from something like that. And it's a prime example of what Alan Massey was saying in that review about your use of detail. And the details are obviously also so carefully wrought. And it's through Christine's attitude and this sort of quite strong, almost negative attitude that she's enjoying.
Yeah.
But many of the details are almost like dark jewels. You've got the vomiting boy. You've got the misused condoms. You've got the boy who's spitting onto the greyhound on the bed of straw. I wonder, do you actually, are these remembered details or are they imagined details?
Well, it's very difficult to say. The strange thing is I don't sort of plan an enormous amount ahead. Mm-hmm. It's something with me, I think, intuitive. Mm-hmm. And these things slip into my mind and I suddenly realize they're there. And
right.
They become part of the text. Mm-hmm. And I don't think to myself, now I must create an atmosphere at which one can be disgusted.
Right.
I mean, it just happens that way.
Did you have a fairground in store that you?
Oh yes. I had this visit to the fairground. Yes. but I hadn't decided what was going to happen.
Right.
And then as I was describing it, I mean, I had this central idea of the wheel, the Ferris wheel getting caught, and his terror, but that was all.
Right.
And then all those other details somehow come out of one's intuition and suggest it's a sort of almost automatic process.
Right. You speak about some of your books being written automatically. You wrote that in your autobiography.
Yes.
There were three at that point that you felt were written automatically.
Yes, but I sometimes feel as though somebody else is dictating the book to me.
Was there a sense of that in that passage?
Yes.
Yes.
I mean, the book, Act of Darkness, which I think is one of my best books, I had this strange sensation that somebody was sort of dictating me and pushing me along a road.
Good for them. And Dylan Thomas said of you, "He's been watching me. He's been listening to me all evening. He has eyes and ears in his bloody ass."
Yes.
And I read that and thought, well, that's a description of a novelist. And then I thought on, and I thought, well, it's not really. I'm a novelist, and it's not a description of me particularly. And I think it is a quality that seems to be quite heightened in you, this quality of sort of hyper-alertness for detail. Are you always alert for material?
Yes, very much so.
Right.
And very much with speech. I mean, very often I'm cursing mobile phones, but I also love listening to people on mobile phones because I catch the way they speak and particularly the pace of the dialogue.
Right.
The way they pace, the way they speak.
Is that one of the
rhythm?
Right, because the dialogue in here is very surreal for me from the 40s. It brings it alive for me. I wasn't there, of course, but I love the novels of Patrick White, but his novels always, well, he set them in sort of latter years up to the 50s, the 60s. They always seem to be locked somehow in his childhood, in his time around the 1920s.
Yeah.
And I know Ruth Rendell goes sneaking behind youths on the underground to listen to what they're saying, to try and get that ear.
Yeah.
When I was living in America, I actually came back willfully to Britain because I felt I was losing my sense of how people were speaking now, and I went and taught in schools to get that sense again. Yeah. But you have it. You know, in your writing, you actually have that 21st century voice. You're writing about sort of upwardly mobile London and immigrant London, and how do you manage to stay alert and keep your ear in tune? Is it just overhearing mobile phones?
I don't know, simply by, I may have told some people where I amuse myself very often. I have nothing to do in an afternoon. Mm-hmm. I have my bus pass, and so I go out, and the first bus that comes, I get on it.
Right.
It doesn't matter where it's going, and I see something place that's interesting. And then I get off that bus and I take the next one, the first. And it leads me to all sorts of places I never normally visit.
Right.
And then on those buses, much of the time, I'm alone and I'm listening to what all the passengers are saying. And I find that a wonderfully useful way.
Oh, that's good.
Because as I get older, inevitably, I don't see so many young people, but I hear them a great deal on buses.
Yes, good.
Or underground trains.
Oh, bus culture. Bus pass for life.
I can recommend that to anyone elderly with a bus pass.
Right.
It's an afternoon that doesn't cost anything.
Yes.
And I wrote a little piece about it in the Old Inn. I got a letter from a woman saying, if you're coming to Stamford Brook or somewhere, I can't remember where it was, do pop in and I'll make you a cup of tea.
Right. In your autobiography, which was written in the 70s, you wrote about a novel that you had written that was rejected, because it would have been your fourth novel, I think.
Yeah.
And it was about German prisoners of war.
Yes, well, I've been working for a long time on this book. Mm-hmm. I mean, it originated in a short story, because I wrote a book called Punishments, mm-hmm. which was about, I was one of them, about English students who went to Göttingen University.
Mm-hmm.
And we were supposed to go in for summer school, but the real idea was that we were going to educate them in democratic ways.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, the book is about this collision in many cases. And in some cases, they became friends, mm-hmm. but also the collision between the English students and the German one. And then I thought I wanted to make a diptych of it and reverse it and have Germans who are exiled in a university town and their relationships with English people.
Right.
And it's, I don't know why, but this book was particularly hard for me to write.
Right.
And I wrote a short story, and from time to time I picked it up. And then I showed it to John Guest, who was then my publisher, is dead now. And he said, I didn't think you're getting anywhere with this, drop it. Mm-hmm. So I abandoned it. And then sort of years later, I started trying to put it together, and I wrote various drafts. And it, as a general rule, I write very fast, mm-hmm. as you can understand when you know that I've written 50 books. I have to write fast. But this one, I just kept going back to and erasing things and adding things mm-hmm. and so on. And then finally I thought, yes, it's okay.
Right. It's a triumph to actually sort of have your book published and the editor that rejected it is now dead.
Yeah. Well, he gave me so much good advice.
Okay.
But I hope that in that case he gave me bad advice.
Right, yes. No, Punishments, this first novel, which deals somewhat with the same theme, a background to the story,
is the
two students are coming from Oxford,
where
they've met these prisoners of war. And but this novel is told in the first person.
Yeah.
And it actually seems to draw on a narrower band of experience, your visit to Göttingen.
Yeah.
And it's a story about teenage first sex and predatory sex. While there's an attempt at reconciliation between the Germans and the English, the title of it, Punishments, is really quite sort of suited to the book.
Yes.
But Cold Snap seems to me, it's in the third person, and it seems to be on a much broader canvas.
Yes, I think it is, yes. I mean, I tend to divide my books first into those in the first person and those in the third person.
Right.
And then there are those which are based on my own experience and those which have nothing to do with, like Act of Darkness, which have nothing to do with my own experience. Mm-hmm. So there's two kinds of books.
Right. I mean,
some books are totally imagined
and
some of them to a large extent are factual. Mm-hmm. But this book has elements of what is autobiographical, but in general it's an imagined story, although the characters, I mean the prisoner and the girl, were in fact real people.
Right.
Yeah.
There seemed to be a maturing of your work still, you seem to be getting stronger ever.
Yes. Well, I had a letter from Hilary, a very nice letter about the book from Hilary Sperling, mm-hmm. who said she thought it was unlike anything that I'd ever written before.
Uh-huh.
And she felt it was a subtle difference.
Right.
And I thought, I was very pleased with that, because if you can change the way you write when you're 86, well, that's something.
It is something, something to work for and look forward to.
Yes.
And people speak about sort of novels being about plot or about character, and yours are obviously clearly on the character side of that scale. But in thinking about it, I also realize that they're also about relationships between characters. And even in this book, there's some very small characters. One is this doctor called Mrs. Graff.
Yes.
But we actually know all about her backstory and her relationships.
Yes.
Even just with these small characters.
Yes.
And I wondered, is this exploration of relationships a really conscious major theme of your writing?
Yes, I think so, yes. And I felt she was, although her appearance is very brief, that she was an important character.
Yeah, and plot-wise as well.
Plot-wise, she represented... not the Germans who had stayed in Germany and taken part in all these horrific things, but who had come to England.
And I was also thinking, when I'm sort of teaching again, I will say to people, well, you can have a weak character in a short story, but a weak character can't sustain a novel. You need a strong character in a novel.
Yeah.
But your characters in the novels are often marginalized, and sometimes they're not playing the more obviously sort of heroic roles. But their huge strength for me is in their self-knowledge, the way they know themselves.
Yeah.
And Christine and Thomas in this one are quite aware, quite articulate about their own weaknesses. The writer in A Domestic Animal loves in the very clear knowledge that he won't be loved back.
Yes.
He's a very strong person in that. And I wondered, in the sense that you have these marginalized characters who gain strength from knowing themselves, just that trait in your characters and that resolute sense of self-knowledge and self-worth stem at all from being a gay writer through a time when being an openly gay writer, which you bravely were, was actually criminal. you know, it was not
yes,
the well
I think
writer,
people
the
should
poets.
Always be themselves.
Yeah.
And the people I'm most attracted to are people who live truly.
Mm-hmm.
And that is something, so in my characters, that's something I value.
Yes.
Those that have a knowledge of themselves.
I noticed that Ivy Compton Burnett said of you, wrote to you in a letter about a domestic animal, "It's better to be drunk with loss and to beat the ground than to let the deeper things gradually escape."
Yes.
And then in Cold Snap, you have Christine say, "Better to make the descent with him over the cliff's edge than to take to the cozy world." I wonder, is that one of the best things fiction can do, to show us that alternative way and
yes,
to make us dare?
Yes, an alternative way of living, yes, yes. Mm. I'm accepting
mm-hmm.
life in all its awfulness as well as all its pleasure.
Right.
Yeah.
And as a gay writer, I feel quite spuriously, I'm sure, that I have some entree into writing from a female perspective. And I'm sure that's to be challenged. You know. In your first book, To the Dark Tower, which was published in 1946,
yes.
When you were still a student at Oxford, it was published the year before this book is set.
Yeah.
You have Frank Caldwell and Sir Hugh Way, and it's a blazingly smart opening to the book, and you just think, well, it could be written now. It's so fresh and so
yeah.
so vivid, and for me also there is this sort of gay frisson going on between Frank Caldwell and Sir Hugh Way.
Yeah.
Then for me, Shirley Fosdyke comes in, and she sort of dampens it for me. I get a bit fed up with Shirley Fosdyke. but here, you've actually got a central character, Christine, who in Punishments, the first book of this diptych, the role that she's playing in this book is played in that book by a male.
Yes.
And here, it's a woman, and for me, she is sort of gloriously rounded and realized and a very rich character. Michael, the gay character in your book, looks on her relationship with what turns out to be misplaced envy, but her relationship is strong because it is so mixed and messy, and I wondered if you could say something about your own reach into a woman's mind and into this straight marriage, which I think you've just accomplished really well here.
Mm. Well, I think, I like to think that I understand women well. And I think one of the reasons is that I, after the age of 13, I was brought up in a household of women. My father had died. And my mother, who was astonishingly a courageous woman, who came home to England just before the war from India, where she'd had a great number of servants, and knew nothing of domestic life, really, at all. And she ran the household, and so on. And then I had three sisters. And so I was sort of very all of us in a flat, not
right.
a huge flat. And I think that way I sort of learned how women feel to a certain extent. And I feel fairly self-confident now
right.
when I write about women. So I think that helped me a great deal.
Right. It seems a particular strength now.
Oh yes, yes. yes. I mean, I think generally, my women characters sometimes work better. I mean, as with Angus Wilson, I think sometimes. I mean, The Widow, my female character, like his Mrs. Elliot, those two women work far better than the other
right.
characters in those books
right.
in which they appear.
Yeah. And as I was growing up and sort of becoming a gay writer, I would look out into the world and I'd find models for myself. And I'd find like Patrick White, Paul Bowles, James Purdy, Mishima, Christopher Isherwood, Jean Genet. I also found yourself. And you were actually, for me, the example of an English writer who was openly gay, but was also a great writer who was dealing with that variety of themes. And I just wondered, did you have any such models, or were you just having to blazingly pioneer yourself?
No, I just felt, as I said, people must be true about themselves. Mm-hmm. And I didn't volunteer information about mm-hmm. myself. But if people asked me, I'd say yes,
mm-hmm.
certainly.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing where I was very fortunate was I had a godfather. And when my father died, he was always kind to me. And he once took me out to lunch in the East India Company and said, "What do you think you're going to do with your life now that it was my last term, or one from last, at Oxford?" And I said, well, my father always wanted me to go into the Foreign Service. And he said, no, no, I honestly don't think that's for you. Mm-hmm. I think we'd be far happier in the British Consul. And I didn't know why he was so sure of this, mm-hmm. but I realized he was a very astute old boy. He wasn't gay himself. Mm-hmm. But he realized I wouldn't fit in a world mm-hmm. where you're expected to lead a conventional life mm-hmm. and have a wife and so on. Mm-hmm. And it was much better to go to the British Consul, mm-hmm. which amazingly, and I think greatly to its credit, was far more tolerant than the rest of the country at that period. Mm-hmm. A lot of the people that were appointed, even to senior positions, were people who were gay, and they knew they were gay, mm-hmm. and that they could rely on them to behave discreetly. And in that way, and also they encouraged a great number of gay writers mm-hmm. that way.
Right.
I mean, James Kirkup is another example of a gay writer who was appointed by the council.
Right.
They knew perfectly well what they were doing.
Mm. So there's some comradeship. At
least there was. Yes, that was very encouraging.
Yeah. And then that's, I know you were born in Switzerland and raised in India,
yes.
so that you you had, being displaced was an element of your birthright in a way.
Yes.
But I also see displacement as being quite a crucial element for writers, being taken out of your realm. And you spoke about when you first went to Greece, that it ended your smog age, that you were coming out into this sort of into this bit of light, and that was in the introduction to the Firewalkers, which is this sort of very upbeat impression of the Greece of those age of that time.
Oh yes,
a very good fun impression. But did leaving England at that point? You'd already got your first book out, but did leaving England help you help you find yourself as a writer?
Yes, yes. Mm. I think the other thing is, I think perhaps we think too much about class in England. Mm-hmm. And the differences one found by going abroad were not differences of class. Mm-hmm. I simply met Italians.
Right.
It didn't matter whether they were school teachers or plumbers. But they were, the difference between us was that I was English and they were Italian.
Right.
And I preferred that sort of difference mm-hmm. to this constant calculation of the class differences.
Right.
And most of my books are very much concerned with differences in nationality mm-hmm. and cultures.
Well, in the books with Germany, it seems they seem to be focusing on this post-war aspect and the healing of the war and the divisions. You go to Japan, but that same war theme, which could apply just as strongly, isn't so current.
Well, in the Custom House, it's quite strong.
Right,
yes. I mean, you know, I had this thing where, I mean, it actually happened in real life when the Japanese said, may we ask a question? I said, yes. Mm-hmm. And said, what about Hiroshima? Quite boldly.
Yeah.
And so then I spoke for a little about that. And then I said, now you must tell me, what about the prisoner of war camps? Mm-hmm. And they were totally silent.
Right.
Yes.
Yes.
I think a lot of them were unaware
right.
of what had been happening. But I've always been very much stimulated by foreign cultures.
And do different countries hold different aspects for you in the fiction? Like you use Egypt quite a bit. You use Japan, as we say. You use India. You use Greece. Does each evoke a different sort of novel, a different sort of fiction?
Yes, I think so. Mm-hmm. And I mean, The Ant Colony, which is one of my better books, one of my favorite books for me. And that is sort of, I think, evokes the spirit of Italy mm-hmm. at that period, soon after the war. Mm-hmm. I think that works fairly well there. I mean, the interesting thing is this interest of mine in Germany. Because, mm-hmm. in fact, I've never lived there. But my grandmother was German.
Oh, yeah.
And so I have German relatives who, again, mm-hmm. I've only met two of them.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm sort of very interested in the whole German history of the family. And my grandmother, I mean, in the First World War, she had a terrible time because her husband, who was Irish, had died. And she was living in Morven with children. Mm-hmm. And some people were kind to her, but some people behaved quite horrifically, not as they behaved in the Second World War.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they really were extremely unpleasant.
Right.
So, you know, I always remembered that. I had this curiosity about the Germans.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to know what they would be like.
Right.
And when they all turned up in Oxford,
then
I wanted to sort of make this exploration.
Yes.
That's really what started me on
the
idea. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And at the end of Yesterday Came Suddenly, you speak of the happiness of writing and you, the fact that you really just enjoy writing and how you're doing it. But you separate that from joy, which you feel the lack of. And in a Domestic Animal, the writer Dick Thompson states, "I believe in sacrifice. Sacrifice gives value to the thing for which it is made. I never really felt wholehearted about my career as a writer until I had cut myself adrift." I wonder, is that sense of separation an intrinsic part of writing for you?
Yes, I think it is, really, yes. Certainly, I get more enjoyment out of writing than out of anything else. Mm-hmm. And a lot of writers, I had a friend, Frank Tui, who was a very fine writer, and he said all the time he was writing, he was thinking, oh God, if only I could get away from this. Mm-hmm. And he was longing for the moment he'd set himself an hour or 2 hours, and then he'd be looking at his watch and get up and think, thank God that's over for today.
Yeah.
With me, it's exactly the opposite. And I shouldn't confess this in front of some of my friends, but quite often when I have friends with me, I look surreptitiously at my watch, thinking I must get back to that chapter.
Now they know. Now they know.
I mean, it is what really gives me the greatest pleasure.
Right. Mm. And as you push on through your 80s, and do you find extra fascination in the effects of aging? Is it providing new material for you, for fiction?
Yes, certainly, yes. I think with my little eye, there was quite a lot about getting old and infirm. Mm-hmm. That was my last novel before this one. There was quite a lot about that, yes.
Do you see us having the first novel, the first great novel from a centenarian? How do you?
Well, I don't know. What I don't want is, you know, when people say it's a wonderful novel for somebody of 86,
okay.
You know, I just want to stop.
And what I'd like to do now is, we've got a roving microphone in the house, and there's a lot of people with, well, already there's a question shooting up at the front. If you just wait for the microphone and then.
Francis, I believe that you started as a poet, is that right?
Yes, that's right, yes. I think it was because I was very busy working on the land. And so it was much easier to write poetry than to write a novel. Because during the war, I was a conscientious objector on the land. And all through the day, these agricultural jobs became just mechanical. I could do them without thinking at all. So I would sort of compose verse in my mind all through the day. And then I tied it up in the evening. And eventually, with luck, I published it very often in The Listener, where Joe Ackley liked my work. So I wrote poetry. That was what I first wrote. I still occasionally write poetry, but then I moved more and more into fiction.
Francis, I haven't read all your poetry
books. Oh, great.
Okay. Francis, it's, I don't know if you remember. Is this working?
Yes.
I think it was Andre Assaman who said, "Exile is a song written in the key of loss." And I know, sharing, like you, a childhood in another country.
Yes, but
you
had a very similar childhood.
Very similar childhood. And I've always felt it was a huge plus because it meant I didn't belong anywhere, and I think you feel that.
Yes,
and
yes.
For a writer, don't you think that you can thereby conceal any, you know, not conceal, you like a chameleon, you can enter into other people because you don't have
yes,
a burrow of your own.
Yes,
you know?
Yes.
Do you feel
yes,
that?
I do. Yes, you're absolutely right, yes.
Do you feel that comes from exile, or is it also part of a writer's nature?
It may be part of a writer's nature as well, yes. But there was this sort of feeling of not knowing where precisely. I mean, until I was 21, I could have been Swiss. I had dual nationality.
Right.
I had to opt when I was 21, so I could easily be talking to some Swiss bookshop in some Swiss bookshop at this moment.
They'll be calling you tomorrow.
Yes.
I haven't read all your 50 books, but I think I probably read about 40. And I do think with Hilary Sperling that this is very different. And I would say that this is far the most tender book that I've ever read of yours.
Yes,
I think that love affair
yes.
is so beautiful and it's so tender. One or two little points. I'm now, you mentioned earlier about your ability to empathize with women because of your woman-heavy background. But also, don't you feel that you are more in contact with the feminine side of yourself, being gay, like I am? You know, that I feel that I can write women because I because I because because a lot of straight men, they're taught to kind of reject their feminine side. And I wonder if that's the case with you.
The curious thing is I'm not aware of sort of very strongly of a feminine side. I never think of myself in that context. I don't think of myself as having a feminine side.
What? You know what it's like to love a man.
Well, yes, one knows that, of course, yes. Yes, that to some extent indicates that, yes. There's somebody over here.
Thank you. I haven't yet read your book, Francis, so I'm much looking forward to doing so. So maybe this is a silly question. But I got up to Oxford in 1948, and as I remember it, it was the Oxford of C.S. Lewis, of Tolkien, of Kenneth Tynan, of Shirley Williams, of Edward Boyle, Tony Richardson, John Schlesinger, to name but a few of the people who were there then. And does any of that sort of impact on this novel?
No. No, I mean, I knew practically all the people you've mentioned. I knew practically all those people. But it's more the ordinary, not somebody like Ken Tynan having a love affair. No, it's the sort of ordinary undergraduates, how they would react in ordinary prisoners of war. No, so they don't really. But there is one scene where, I mean, I was able, which actually occurred, with the Balliol Music Society. And I was deeply shocked at that time that after the war, you would have thought no one would be anti-Semitic. And there was this character who, in fact, existed in real life, arranging the concert and said, do we really want to have the Jew boy so-and-so sing the tenor role? And that amazed me, you know, that people could use that sort of vocabulary in the immediate aftermath of the war. One could understand it before the war. And I don't know if you remember this, but in fact then, there were sort of some quite ardent fascists still around. I mean, a writer called Desmond Stewart, who was a friend of mine, a very good writer, but he was a great admirer of Hitler, would talk about the leader, even when the leader was dead.
Mine was just a tiny point. I was going to reply to the last speaker because I have read the novel. What impacts is Oxford. And what impacts, and I said it in the small mention I made in the Kensington magazine, is the Oxford of your youth, which is slightly before the Oxford of my youth.
Yeah.
But the detail that comes out is a bit in Port Meadow. And you see the grass under the ice. And I remember that in the cold winter of 1963. I was a child in the winter of 47. But,
yes.
But Kemp Cafe, things that were part of post-war Oxford. And they're so sharply, wonderfully delineated. I mean, it just has a freshness as though you'd seen those things yesterday. It's Oxford as it was.
Well, it was rather strange because I did find that a friend of mine, Brian McGuinness, one of my closest friends at Oxford, and he's a philosopher now, but he wrote to me and said, I'd forgotten all this. How did you remember it? But the funny thing was, I didn't remember it until I started writing, and then suddenly all these things, I think most novelists find this, that they suddenly surge upwards, and I remembered all these small details from life then. And even the names, I mean, I'd forgotten that we used to eat in a restaurant called Kemp's, and I mentioned that, and that restaurant really existed. I'd totally forgotten, and then suddenly this name came back.
Do you ever choose to sort of write into an area for that pleasure of having the memories and the stories present themselves? Like, was there a conscious wish, for example, to evoke Oxford of the 1940s here?
No.
No.
Well, the curious thing is that period is one which has always sort of obsessed me in memory. Mm-hmm. I think a great deal of that period. because it was such a change in my life, having worked on a farm for more than three years, to come back to Oxford. Mm-hmm. And I felt sort of a juvenile. A lot of the people I made friends with had been through the war. Mm-hmm. Some of them even got married and so on.
Yeah.
And I felt much younger than them.
Mm-hmm.
So that sort of had a great effect on me. Mm-hmm. But the curious thing also was that I felt it was a period of expectation and hope, which I always remember, that mm-hmm. despite all these appalling hardships, it was a period of hope and people really believed things are going to improve and so on.
Does that resonate at all with now for you, with 2010?
No, I'm afraid not.
Not at all. There's no hope for us.
I must tell you a very funny story about the deprivations of the time. I invited two girls from Somerville, two students, to tea. And they came in and they were giggling and they said to me, one of them said, "Can you imagine what we've been doing this afternoon?" And I said, "No." And she said, "Spending the afternoon in bed together." But I'm afraid I got quite the wrong idea, so I was terribly taken aback. I mean, first, I didn't know them all that well to confess this to me. However, it then turned out it was simply so cold, the gas had been turned off, and they'd gotten to bed together to get warm. So that's the way people lived then.
Francis, to shift gears for a second, could you reflect for a moment on how your career as a theater critic, which I believe was of many years' duration, has had an impact upon your writing of fiction?
My career as
Your career as a theater critic.
Oh, theater critic. I was a theater critic for about 8 years, 9 years. I don't think it really had much impact on my writing of fiction, though I enjoyed it. And the other great thing was that... writing reviews, literary reviews, is not a particularly gainful employment. But being a theatre critic, I was well paid, and so I had sort of 10 years. I could almost imagine that I was rich. But I don't think it had... So it had an impact on my lifestyle, let us say. But I can't say that it had a great impact on the way that I looked at the world. So I enjoyed it enormously, and I did... try writing a play, but alas, it wasn't a success, so I gave up and thought novels were what I better stick to.
And short stories as well.
And short stories, yes. Yeah.
How do you see the difference? Are short stories sort of novels that wanted to grow?
I think that it's a mistake mm-hmm. to write what might have been a novel as mm-hmm. a short story. Mm-hmm. I think it's a totally separate entity.
Right. Mm-hmm. And your novels are generally quite quite spare. And,
yes, yes.
And do you spend a lot of time sort of trimming back?
Particularly with this novel.
Yeah.
But this one, I mean, I did a great deal of trimming back and then adding.
Mm-hmm.
It was, I mean, I've never spent so much time removing things and putting things in.
Yeah.
Most of the books, I say, I do quite quickly. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I have written some long novels as well. I mean, mm-hmm. Act of Darkness was long.
Yeah, some Prodigies.
The Widow was long. The Custom House mm-hmm. was long. And Prodigies... Mm-hmm. And that was a book, my one disappointment was a book called Prodigies, which I thought was one of the best books I'd written. Mm-hmm. And I think it was entirely to do with the way it was printed, because it was a very long book, and it was printed with very small mm-hmm. type. And a lot of people said, I just can't read this, my eyes can't take it in. And I was sorry about that. But the other day, surprisingly, I got a letter from Nicola Bowman, you know, who runs Persephone. And she just read it, and she was very enthusiastic. Mm-hmm. So then I began to feel, well, perhaps it wasn't a failure at all.
It can still find its way.
Yes.
This book has got remarkably large type. It's
good. Yes, well, I think it's very... I'm not saying it's to sell it, but even for the people with the worst possible sight, even if you have glaucoma, you can read this. Also, I'm very pleased with that photograph because it's so entirely of its period. And my publisher, Gary, very sweetly sent me a number of photographs. And immediately I thought, that's the one that is 1947. Mm. That woman, I mean, that figure of the woman, is absolutely a 1947 mm. figure.
Now looks very like yourself, Francis.
What?
Now
You think it might be myself? Yeah.
Any more questions?
Having written this extraordinary number of books, you must have at any time one that you're writing, one that you're planning, one that you're revising, one that you're promoting. Can you give us some idea of your working patterns, your working day?
Well, I don't have any fixed hours for work. I just work whenever the hours are there. And I find writing also very consolatory, that if I'm worried about things, not concerning me necessarily, the members of the family and so on. When I settle down to write, I concentrate so entirely on what I'm writing that I forget about everything else. So that is what I sort of really enjoy most, as I've said, and what I spend most of my time doing. I'm very bad, as I think Gary, my publisher, who's sitting next to you would agree, at promoting. I get extremely embarrassed by the idea of going out and promoting, and I know you have to do it today, and some of my friends who are very good novelists, and they trudge around and make speeches all over England, and I just can't bring myself to do it. But that is something I don't really do very much. But usually when I finish the book, very quickly I get an idea for another one, and then I start on that. And it's usually when the book is finished that I then start revising it. I don't revise it as I go along. I wait till I've got some sort of draft, and then I revise it. And that's where, thank God for a computer, because in the old days, sort of retyping the whole thing was such a burden. And this way, it's so much easier, excising things, adding things.
Time for one more? No?
Any more? No? Well, thank you, Frances and Martin, for a wonderful evening. I hope Frances will be able to sign copies of books if you want to buy any, and please have another glass of wine.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Martin. Hello.
Hello, Frances, how are you?
Yes, certainly.